tell me your name?
Andrew Fountain.
Okay, and what are you doing here in Antarctica?
I study the glaciers of the dry valleys.
And what is it that you study about them?
Well, there's two things, actually. One is that we just studied the change of the glaciers, whether they're growing bigger or smaller. That includes, it's a more subtle aspect of it, are they increasing or decreasing in mass? That's what we're really interested in. But then that gets manifested as them getting larger or smaller. And the difference is there's a dynamic response. There's a mass change, and then at some time later, the glacier changes.
How do you measure the mass change of a glacier? That's a
huge... Well, actually, it's as simple as a ruler, because what we do is we put stakes into the ice, and then if the surface lowers relative to the stake, so the stake looks like it's becoming longer, mm-hmm. we know we're losing mass. And conversely, if snow accumulates on the stake, against the stake looks like it's getting shorter, then we have mass accumulation. And if we know the density of the surface, we measure that. Then we know if, then we add all these up and average them, and then we know if the glacier is increasing in mass or decreasing in mass.
So a glacier is going to have the same kind of, take up the same kind of distance based on its thickness? I'm just, how do you measure how far it's creeping forward?
Yeah, that's right. Glaciers obviously flow downhill, and they're constrained at the upper end by the mountain, so the only place it can go is downhill. Mm-hmm. So we really only have to measure the perimeter of the glacier at the down valley end of it,
uh-huh.
and we can see it, well, we can measure it going forward or going backward.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the States and elsewhere in the world, these glaciers are retreating really rapidly, so literally by going out in every year and just maybe surveying the perimeter of the glacier, then coming back next year, surveying the perimeter again, you can see the change quite easily. Here, the changes are so small that the only realistic way for us to do it, the only realistic way for us to do it right now is through photography, comparing it to the old photographs. I mean, we can survey it, but we wouldn't get any good data for another 20 years, so we kind of have to rely on what's been happening in the past. And since there wasn't survey data back in the past, we have to rely on photographs, which show us essentially that these glaciers aren't changing.
Hmm. And how did you get into doing this? How did you first?
Down
in Antarctica.
Oh, so see, this is part of a larger project, this LTER project, Long-Term Ecological Research. So my colleagues are studying the ecosystem in this valley, which is, you know, there's no higher plants or animals. It's all microbes, basically. But what drives the whole thing is water from the glaciers. Without the glaciers melting each summer a little bit, you wouldn't have any water, and therefore you wouldn't have any ecosystem. So I was asked to join the group of biologists to identify the processes that control water flow from the glaciers. And that's the other thing that I do.
Mm-hmm.
The mass change of the glaciers, and that's kind of a climate change issue. But then the real thing that I'm hired to do is try to understand how these glaciers melt and supply water to the ephemeral streams and the ice-covered lakes in the valley.
So when you say ecosystem, is that's meaning the life that's down there?
Yes.
And what's special about the ecosystem in the dry valley?
Well, there's two things, actually. Like I said, it's microbially dominated. No place else on Earth isn't microbially dominated. As soon as you get plants or higher animals, they become the main parts of the ecosystem around which the microbes sort of play against. Here, it's only microbes, and they're only kind of dealing with each other. And microbes, as in phytoplankton in the lakes, there's some algae in the streams, and then in the soils, there are these small worm-like critters called nematodes. So these guys all kind of interact. So that's part A. It's a microbially dominated ecosystem, which is highly unusual. Plus, the dry valleys is basically the last terrestrial ecosystem on Earth. If you go any further south, it all becomes ice-covered. So we're really at the limit of terrestrial life forms. And I don't mean just bacteria sitting there. I mean terrestrial life forms in an ecosystem of lakes, soils, and streams.
Mm.
So it's that interaction. If it gets a little bit colder, everything's kind of shut down and covered with ice.
Would you say that this is, some of the people I talked to sort of described it as an interesting place to do research because it's kind of a simplified ecosystem, so you can break down really basic aspects of the ecosystem. Would you say that, or would you describe it in a different way?
No, I think that's accurate. You know, it's not simple, but it's simplified. And the advantage we have is that we can essentially draw a box around it and say this is the ecosystem, whereas back home, you have birds flying through, you know, you have deer walking through. It's sort of hard to say, you know, this is a contained system because there's so much flux in and out of this thing. So here we are, and we can hopefully actually identify the entire cycle of nutrients through this system, carbon or phosphorus or what have you. And you can't do that anywhere else. So we might be able to identify some basic processes, some basic ecological processes of how nutrients move through the system that you can't do anywhere else.
And what's the benefit of doing that?
Well, that's going to the basis of ecosystem function and how does carbon move through the ecosystem. That's kind of the main issue, really. Yeah, I mean, the nematodes were, for example, you know, we have three species down here, and back home there's hundreds. You know, so by having a simplified system, we can really look at how these different microbes exchange the energy and exchange the nutrients.
So you've got these MET stations all over the place. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of that and why they were?
The meteorological stations were put in almost 14 years ago at the start of the project, where we're trying to define the climatic, or I should say the meteorological environment of the valleys. And because we were unsure what the environment was like. There had been past measurements, but it's been like a single station in some other valley or something. And of course, we're interested on how the weather would change along the valley axis and with altitude up the valley sides. Because putting a meteorological station in the valley bottom, you might have differences up on the glacier where we're getting the water from. So we put a number of stations in the valley. We have eight in Taylor Valley, and then we have three other stations elsewhere in adjacent valleys. And we've been using that to identify what the environment is like. And it's actually turned out to be very interesting in two aspects. One is we found that, believe it or not, the temperature, air temperature, gets warmer as you go inland towards the ice sheet. You'd expect the exact opposite. Oh, there's the ice sheet, it must be colder. There's the shoreline, it must be warmer. It's the exact opposite. And that's because the air, well, it's actually the air comes off the sea ice, which is fairly cold, and moves in the valley, versus the air that drains off of the ice sheet. And as it drains down into the valley, it actually heats up. So the air coming from the ice sheet in many cases is actually a little bit warmer than the air coming in from the coast that's already cold from that ice. So that's one thing. And the other thing, like you just mentioned, is katabatic winds. Climate change for us could be a change in the frequency of katabatic winds, because we found that for every 10%, how does it work? Yeah, for every 10% change in the frequency of katabatic winds, so in other words, if it goes from, say in the wintertime, it goes from 40% of the time katabatic winds to 50%, the average temperature in the valley will increase by a degree.
Wow.
That's because the winds are coming down, heating up as they come down to lower elevations. And there's very good physical reasons why this happens. And that warms up the valley bottom. So if we have more of those winds, as far as our temperature gauges are concerned, we're having a warming. So if we have more of those winds, it gets warmer.
Right.
So our climate change could be just wind change.
Wow.
So,
and the ecosystem can handle that much of a change?
Well, yeah. We'll see, won't we?
Mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, it doesn't really matter too much whether the temperature goes from minus 40 to minus 30. You know, everything's kind of sleeping anyway. But in the summertime, that could mean the difference between meltwater and no meltwater. So it's kind of like this abrupt change, you know, nothing, bang, meltwater. So that's where it would really play a big role.
And then it's gone, the meltwater is gone, unless it, there's a lot of snow or something later on.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's just kind of backtrack, because you're kind of going way above my understanding. How does this meteorological phenomenon and processes play into an ecosystem? I wonder if you could kind of just break down for us this energy balance.
Sure. So it would seem like a no-brainer, right? You have this ice. If you increase the temperature, you get water. It's above freezing, right? Mm-hmm. And the higher or the warmer the temperature is above freezing, the more melting you get. I mean, we kind of know that from snow on our sidewalks, how fast it melts away is based partly on, you know, how warm the air is. Well, down here, this is true everywhere, but it's kind of better highlighted down here, and that is the warmer the temperature maybe melts the ice more, but then the dry winds come through and it evaporates the water. Mm. So for us, really, then, it's a competition between how much water is produced and how much is evaporating. And you can see this kind of demonstrated by analogy back home. When you see the rain coming from the clouds and it never reaches the surface, mm-hmm. that's because there's rain coming out of the cloud, but it's evaporating so fast mm-hmm. it never gets to the floor of the valley. We're, in the same sense, these glaciers are melting water, but they're also evaporating at the same time. Mm. A more subtle aspect to this is when the temperature is actually below freezing a little bit. The sunlight can warm up the ice to cause it to melt. The air temperature can be below freezing a few degrees, but the ice surface can be above freezing due to the warmth of the sunlight. If the wind is fairly calm, as soon as you get any amount of wind, that wind removes the heat, keeps the ice surface frozen. Mm. So then it becomes a competition between how much sunlight there is, air temperature, and how much wind there is to remove the heat. In a sense, like wind chill, you know.
Right.
And that's kind of that's kind of the basis of the energy balance, is this competition of processes adding heat and subtracting heat. And because our system is fairly close to freezing, we get pretty dramatic responses due to small changes. If we were really cold, like in the wintertime, not much happens despite big changes in the environment. Kind of like what we talked about with catabatic wind. So what if it raised the temperature 10 degrees?
Right.
If it goes from minus 40 to minus 30, nothing happens. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if it's really warm and it's, say, 10 degrees and goes up to 12 degrees, yeah, you get some more melt, but nothing really changes. It's that threshold between below freezing and just above freezing, mm-hmm. no melt and water everywhere. That's kind of where we're at.
Where there's a transformation from the solid state to the liquid state.
Right.
Now, Matt and Hassan were telling me that, or suggesting that the energy balance, that there's this energy balance equation. That's a very simple equation, but then when you kind of put it into practice, it's really complex.
That's right.
Is that right? What is the equation?
Well, the equation simply is the amount of sunlight coming in versus the amount that's reflected. So it's kind of the net amount of sunlight coming in. And then you have the wind, which not only, depending on the difference between the temperature of the air and the ice, either brings heat to the ice or takes heat away. So if the air temperature is warmer than the ice, it'll bring heat to the ice, or vice versa. The wind also has humidity. So if it's really dry, it'll tend to evaporate the ice, or if there's water present, tend to evaporate the water. So depending on what the humidity of the air is, it can take more or less heat away. And then because our average temperature is like minus 20 C here, there's conduction, ground conduction of heat. As the surface of the ice warms up due to either the air temperature or the sunlight, the heat at the surface will begin to become conducted down into the body of the glacier where it's really cold.
Right.
So sunlight warms the ice, Wind can either add heat or take away heat. It tends to evaporate the surface, which is a heat loss. Mm-hmm. And then there's heat conducted from the surface into the bottom of the ice. And then when you add all these up, you either have energy left over for melt or not.
Oh, okay.
And if you don't, it cools the ice.
So your elements of the equations are wind, sun, and conduction of the ice, basically.
Right, yeah.
And then how do you measure each of those elements? Do you measure the elements separately and then kind of make the equation? Or
mm-hmm. Well, pretty much. The weather stations that you saw out there tell us what the wind is doing. It tells us what the humidity of the air is doing. It tells us what the air temperature is doing. Then we have thermometers in the ice that tell us what the ice temperature is. So we know the difference in the ice temperature. So we know something about the heat being conducted in. We know about the wind, so we know about the addition or subtraction of energy through the wind. And then we also have solarimeters that measure the intensity of the sun mm-hmm. coming in. Mm-hmm. And we also have an additional device that measures the reflectance from the ice surface. So we know the net amount of sunlight that gets into the ice. Uh-huh. You know, it's the difference between the amount coming in and the amount being reflected.
Right.
But there's subtleties with this that make things difficult, actually.
Mm-hmm. For example?
There's two things that I think of offhand. One is just the difference in surfaces across the glacier. Just because you're measuring mm-hmm. what you are at that one site doesn't mean 10 yards away it's exactly the same.
Right.
And, you know, weather-wise, it's pretty much the same, but the difference might be snow cover on the surface. This might be bare ice, which is less reflective than the snow-covered ice just over there. Mm-hmm. Big difference, because since that has more reflection, it's getting less solar radiation into the ice, much less heating of the ice, and that's completely different energy-wise than this piece of bare ice here.
Right.
That's one thing. The other thing is that because we're right near the melting point, like I said, small differences in the meteorological environment can make a big change.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we just losing a little bit of heat of the ice, or is the ice gaining a little bit of heat that would cause melting? Well, now we're getting down to the error of the instruments. And this might be something that Matt or Hassan might have said, that we can measure the wind speed, say, to 5%, which is great. But when you're right around the hinge point, 5% might be the difference between melting and nothing.
Uh-huh.
So that's where it gets really difficult.
So every year,
and I can go on,
oh, yeah.
But
no,
I won't.
Please.
No. I don't think you have enough film.
Right.
But there's a lot of issues kind of like this.
Well, what I was going to say is that then every year it seems. And correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of people come down to the valleys to do research with LTER and to maintain these met stations and things. And I wonder if you, and you spoke also about, you know, before we started filming, about how wonderful experience it is to be on a glacier. Can you speak to why it's important for people, you know, you've got these automatic met stations and they could be sending data, you know, automatically and people wouldn't have to spend the money and the trouble to come down here. What is it that's beneficial about people actually being in the valleys, and what kinds of things are important about that?
Well, for us, you know, there's kind of two ways to look at it. One is just the maintenance of the instruments. Because, for example, measuring the sunlight with a sensor that's like this. Well, if a windstorm comes along and it bends the sensor, we wouldn't necessarily know that. We would just say, oh, it's getting a lot cloudier or something, you know. So just the basic visits to the stations really help. But also, just because you have the data doesn't mean you understand the system. It's important to come down and view the landscape, and in our case, view the glaciers, and seeing how the glaciers are reacting to these changing environments. And that kind of feeds into our understanding and kind of non-quantitative ways. It's like all of a sudden you realize, oh, this is happening. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Uh-huh.
So for example, we've seen, the instruments tell us that there might be some melt at a station. So why isn't the, why aren't the streams running much more full? So for example, we're on one of the glaciers, Taylor Glacier, and we're walking along, and we actually saw some melt. And it was just a little layer of water kind of bleeding over the surface as if somebody had just spilled a drink. But it got to a certain point where apparently the wind regime was a little bit different because of the roughness of the glacier was a little bit different. It stopped and it froze in place.
Uh-huh.
So if our met station was at the origin of the water, it would have told us it was melting. And then 10 feet away, it froze.
Right.
And that's not where our met station is. So it kind of helps to kind of see this. So when we do our modeling of the glacier surface, we're a lot more aware of the subtleties that could happen.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there'll ever be instrumentation that can take into account all of these subtleties, or it's just something about, you know, unless it was, it's just something about being a human being and being able to experience
well,
this stuff?
This is the fundamental argument that NASA's had,
okay,
you know, since its inception.
Right.
You know, you want to put a guy in space at great cost, or can you just send up a satellite and do the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, depending on what you want to do, you don't want to keep a human circling the Earth taking pictures, you know, for
right.
20 years. A satellite's great at doing that. But to kind of see what the condition of the Earth is, or have a visceral feel of what the surface of the moon is, maybe it's worth the expense to do that. So we're kind of in the same boat. But having said that, there is a cost-effective approach to automating a lot of our instruments. So for example, rather than, right now the way our instruments work is you have to go to the weather station and then you have to download the data, you have to take the can, and that's a good thing in the sense that it makes us check out the station and see how it's doing. But we could reduce our visits by half, say, if it would be telemetered.
Mm, okay.
If we sent it out by satellite.
Yeah,
because
like the AWS station.
Right, right. And it's not, in this case, it's not so much the problem of the sensor tilting, but in this case, it's the situation of the met station falling over.
Oh.
If it, it's happened before.
Mm.
A big windstorm comes, the station falls over. Then we would know we would have to make a special visit so we don't lose a lot of data, or we just visit once a year, and if all the instruments look fine, great, we'll just come back next year and not come back again the same year.
Right.
So that kind of thing would really help out a lot.
Hmm. And, so now you're going to be overseeing the whole LTER?
Yeah, that's right.
System coming soon, and what is the entire LTER? What does that consist? That's more than just Antarctica. It's
well, no.
Oh, you'll be overseeing the Antarctic area.
Yeah, the long-term ecological research program has 26 sites,
mm.
24 of which are in the U.S.
Wow.
Alaska has two, Oregon has one, California might have two or three, Colorado has two,
mm.
Michigan has one. You know, so there's a lot of these sites, and then Antarctica has two, one on the peninsula, the Antarctic Peninsula at Palmer Station,
mm-hmm.
and they're basically an Antarctic marine-based project, and then the other one is us here, where we're an Antarctic terrestrial-based project.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll only be taking over our project here at the Dry Valleys.
Okay, which involves, what's the scale of something like that?
Well, it involves eight universities. And eight scientists from different universities, and it's basically managing the budget and trying to focus the resources on whatever problem or focus we choose in this coming year. Because we're limited by resources, not everybody can come here and do what they want. We have to say, okay, what are our choices? What's most important to do this year?
Mm-hmm.
We have core measurements, like the glaciers and the weather. There's others in the lakes and the streams. So we have those core measurements. And then we have resources left over in terms of helicopter time and allowing people to come into Antarctica. And then we divvy those up according to what we want to do from year to year. So, for example, Peter Norton, you talked to him before. If he has a dive season where he's looking at the algal mats in the bottom of the lake. So he needs a lot of people to do that. So those resources have to be drawn from other projects. So he can't do that every year, but he does it every so often. And then the rest of our projects, like mine, for example, I might have fewer people in the field that year as we kind of help him. Or conversely, he helps me some other year.
When you talk about the core measurements, you're talking about this, the LT part of the LTER, the idea. And can you explain that a little bit? What is so important about this being a long-term project? What's special about that?
Well, the typical National Science Foundation project, and for that matter, the NASA project, is on 3-year cycles. So you propose your project. If you get funded, then you have 3 years to do what you need to do. And that's fine for a lot of things. If you want to understand, say, for example, how a glacier flows, and you're just trying to look at the basic mechanics of that, maybe 3 years is sufficient to figure that out. But in our system, where we're looking really at ecological responses to meteorological or climate forcing, it's really important to look at this over the long term, because we don't know what the weather is going to be or what the weather might do. So for example, not using our site as an example, but let's use the one in Puerto Rico. Their system is dominated by hurricanes that come through and devastate the forest, and then the ecosystem responds to that. So if you have a 3-year project, that doesn't mean you're going to get a hurricane through that time period. And say you do get a hurricane through that time period, well, you might not have enough funding to see the complete response of the system to that catastrophic event. For us, for example, our catastrophic or our big event is this melt year that you might have heard of.
Oh, yeah, when was that?
That was 2001.
Okay, yeah.
And that's when the temperature actually went up to 4 degrees C, so what's that, you know, like 35 degrees for 3 weeks. So it wasn't like all summer, it was like 3 weeks. Mm. There's water all over the place. And so we're able to catch that because we have a long-term project, and then we could follow the response of the system to that. So in our system, that was increased sediment flow to the lakes, which partly added nutrients to the lake, which is a good thing for the phytoplankton, but then it also created kind of sediment-laden water, which reduced the amount of light to the organisms. So it was sort of you know, wasn't sure if this was good or bad because they got less light, but they had more nutrients. So maybe it was a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
But sediment on the glaciers changed a lot, and I think we're still seeing the response.
Which would be more melting,
because what happened was during that big melt year, the surface of the glacier, in a sense, was just melted off, revealing a lot of the sediment that was in the ice. Now it's sitting on top of the surface.
Wow.
Next year comes along, and that melts in a little bit more, and increases the melt compared to a normal year when you wouldn't have that process.
Right.
So it's these kind of funny feedback mechanisms that we wouldn't have anticipated. So that's a nice thing about a long-term project.
You mentioned forcings. Now my understanding of forcings is like a volcano or what's been happening with CO2 in the atmosphere. Are forcings in the case of the Dry Valleys project and the Antarctic projects, is that melt or?
Well, it could be.
It could be anything.
Yeah, well, but it depends on where you are,
okay.
Right? If you're a stream, you're being forced by the glacier. If you're the glacier, you might be forced by the weather. But since we try to take a holistic view of this, of the situation, our forcing essentially is the weather, which affects the glaciers and then the stream flow and the lakes. And then another one actually are the katabatic winds. Not only because of the weather, but it also blows a lot of the sediment around the valleys, which help melt the ice on the lakes because, you know, it gets on the lakes, helps melt the glaciers, and it also helps to transport biological organisms through the valley.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas we might have separate landscape elements, the soils kind of do their thing, the streams kind of do their thing, the lakes kind of do their thing, and they're not very well connected because back home we have rain.
Yeah.
That rains all over everything, and then the water is just connecting all the soils to the streams to the lakes, or you have animals or something moving through the system. We don't have any of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the only mechanism where these different landscape elements get really connected would be the wind.
And do the organisms themselves serve as forcings, or not really?
Not so much.
Mm-hmm.
And is this environment down here affected by, you know, because you're talking about the rains, and that made me think of acid rain and how, you know, different regions are affecting each other because of the winds. Is the LTER seeing down here, seeing an effect from things that are happening in the rest of the world?
Yes and no. In many ways, we're isolated from the rest of the world. We don't really have much of an El Nino effect here, for example. I mean, we've been looking for an El Nino effect for a long time. We just don't see anything, at least not in the response of our system. And in a way, we're kind of an anomaly. In fact, a lot of East Antarctica, where we are, is an anomaly, where the rest of the world seems to be warming up, and we're actually cooling down here. And this kind of adds to the complexity of people's understanding of climate change. This is going to be a little bit of a long-winded answer, but see, climate change, everybody wants to simplify it to say, oh, everything's warming, but there's different patterns to this. And there's no reason to think why the whole Earth should warm up uniformly across everywhere. Why can't there be differences across the globe? And Europe might be warming faster than the U.S. because of the way the winds are flowing across the Atlantic. And then it might shift because of the wind pattern shifts across the globe. Well, for us down here, what we're having is, the best of our understanding, is we have the ozone hole that occurs mostly in the winter, and we're losing heat out of the ozone hole. And as the subtropics warm and East Antarctica cools because of the ozone hole, you have this temperature difference, which causes the winds to circulate around Antarctica faster.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, when they circulate around Antarctica faster, they isolate Antarctica from the warming at the higher, I guess it's the lower latitudes.
Mm-hmm.
They isolate it from the subtropics. So here we're kind of sitting in this this protected area that's losing heat through the ozone hole, so we're cooling down.
Mm-hmm.
So people are saying, like in Michael Crichton's book, State of Fear,
right,
or Ann Coulter's book, we've been referenced in both.
Oh, you too, oh boy.
Yeah, this is great. Global change isn't happening because they're cooling. Well,
right,
there's a way to explain this that's consistent with global warming and the addition of the ozone hole. So what we're finding then is our system, our valley, this finally gets back to your question, our valley is actually cooling down. The ecosystem is responding in the sense that the number of nematodes in the soil are decreasing with time. Our ice thicknesses are increasing, which limits the amount of light. And you limit the light, and therefore there isn't as much phytoplankton, active phytoplankton in the lakes. So our system is responding basically to a cooling event.
Mm-hmm.
And our glaciers aren't receding. They're either doing steady or advancing a little bit because everything gets colder.
So I've read some of Richard Byrd's writing, and one thing he says is that weather is born or created at the poles. So it's interesting, based on what you were saying about how, you know, Antarctica is kind of isolated, but at the same time, does it have an effect? Does the fact that this ice is down here and it's not warming and it's not melting, is that having a positive effect on what's happening in the rest of the world, or any kind of effect on the rest of the world?
Oh, sure, because, you know, generally speaking, both poles are losing heat.
Mm-hmm.
So we're part of the heat balance of the Earth. If it wasn't for the net heat loss from the poles, the Earth would continue to warm to a much higher degree.
Mm-hmm.
So we're losing the heat off the poles. And that's just under normal conditions. That's not under climate change conditions. That's just under normal conditions. There's a net heat gain along the equator because that's where the sun is the most intense, and where the sun is the least at the poles, yeah, that's where you have a net heat loss.
Mm-hmm.
But weather being generated at the poles, for Antarctica, even though we're becoming more isolated, you know, we are a heat sink, and we might be more coupled to the subtropics through the ocean currents that bring a lot of heat in from the subtropics to Antarctica, cools down, and then goes back out.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It can be a governor, if you will, of the system that way.
Okay. I guess one of the last things I wanted to ask you about is just the kind of unique nature of the LTER. Some of what I've read about it is talking about being one of the first very interdisciplinary programs kind of from the beginning at a time when that was very unusual.
Right.
And I wonder if you can speak to that.
Well, it's very interesting, for me at least, and that is, just because you get a group of scientists together with different disciplines and say, go do stuff, doesn't mean it becomes interdisciplinary.
Okay.
You know, because there's a whole psychology involved in this. You know, partly it's we're just totally unfamiliar with each other's field. So, for example, my colleague, Diana Wall, who does the nematodes in the soil, how am I supposed to be interacting with that? I don't even know what a nematode is. So it takes a while. The learning process takes a while. And then I think there's certain trust issues. Not that it's a conscious thing, like I don't trust you. It's like, I've never worked with you before. I don't know what your habits are, what your culture is. How do we connect in a way that makes a fruitful study or a fruitful collaboration? So that actually takes a while to partly learn what the other disciplines are and partly get used to each other's working style such that we're comfortable working together. So really, it was only after our first 6 years did we, I think, we really started doing interdisciplinary work. We were working cooperatively before that and friendly, but not interdisciplinary. It was really only after that that I can see what my glacier or weather effects are on the soils and then begin to ask them questions and then begin to interact with them on their studies and vice versa, have them interact with me on mine in kind of a knowledgeable way. In a way that's comfortable for all of us to interact.
And what influence is that having on the scientific research?
Oh, I think it's been great, and you can see it visually because if you look at our papers, they're initially single authored or dual authored, just with people in our own discipline. But as the project matured, it becomes, well, because it's more interdisciplinary, more and more authors of our colleagues show up on these papers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me, it's really broadened my view of what's happening in the valley, whereas before it was just like, oh yeah, glaciers and everything else is sort of whatever, you know.
Right.
Now it's like I have a much wider perspective of how the glaciers are part of the whole system. And vice versa for those guys, people working the lakes now can appreciate how the activity of the soils affect the lakes, that kind of thing.
Would you say that the study, studying climate change and its effect on ecosystems is kind of becoming a discipline in itself, or the disciplines are changing and transforming because of what's being learned about how these systems are integrated, or?
Well, yeah, what's been happening, and I think climate change has really accelerated this process. That to really understand the system, you can't rely just on atmospheric scientists because there's interactions with the ocean, the land, the ice sheets, and that's only in the physical side. Then you have the biology in the oceans and on the lands.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have to bring in the biology, and we're not even talking about human influence yet. So you can just see that all this is kind of dramatically put together. And if you read any of the climate change information or climate change papers from, say, just the ice core studies, you realize you gotta know a lot about a lot of issues. For example, winds bringing up dust. And what does that mean when you have a lot of dust in the ice core? Well, that's from higher winds, say. Well, then what does that mean climatically? So as a glaciologist, you have to kind of understand a lot about terrestrial systems. Or if you see a lot of methane, methane's produced in swamps. Well, where does that come from? So you sort of got into this whole interdisciplinary world that's critical for us to understand how the system's working. And I think back to the LTER, for us to make really big advances now, sure, we can study stream flow, but unless we know more of the biological interactions with the stream flow, we don't have a sense of how the whole system is working. And until you really find that integration, you don't really understand the system. You only understand part of one component.
Mm-hmm.
A trivial example, for example, would be stream flow and how stream flow moves downstream. Sure, it's got slopes and it's got a certain meander to it, and the banks erode or the banks build up, whatever. Well, that's 20 years ago. Now we realize, well, there's plants along the banks. The roots help stabilize the banks. Mm-hmm. Trees fall into the rivers, causing eddies and things like that. So what do we know before, considering the real complexity of the system, and can we really address a lot of these issues by ignoring the riparian or the, you know, the plants on the sides of the river? So it's that kind of thing.
So when you think about it in terms of atmospheric science, and you think about a model that you're creating, that model starts to integrate elements from, you know, humans and the biology and, you know, all that.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
And that's, and what the focus then is on is what is the most, what is the most sensitive part of the system that we don't understand yet? So what I mean is, all right, we know how glaciers flow, fine. Then maybe we don't understand about the weather. Okay, well, we figure out the weather. Well, gee, maybe what it is now, if we figure that out, so maybe it's the amount of dust that gets on the glacier that causes it to melt faster. So maybe we need to know more about that. That might be weather. That just might be, well, where's all the dust coming from? You know. So then what you do is you start out understanding, say, 50% of the problem, and then you understand 75%, and then you understand 80%, and then at some point there's a tipping point between what it costs to get to the next level and how important is that.
Right.
So depending on what the problem is at hand and what the challenge is, you may be a long way away from that, or you may be quite close to it. In terms of climate change, we're still pretty far away from it. To understand all the integrated processes, to really know what the effect of climate will be on us in the next, you know, 20 to 50 years.
Well, this is the thing, because then, you know, people who are non-scientists and scientists alike, it seems, from what I'm understanding from the IPCC and stuff, need to take action. And so how do people understand, you know, I mean, that's what's been a real issue, like with Michael Crichton and, you know, all this debate is, the science isn't telling us everything, but at the same time, we need to take some kind of action about it. So how does that, in your opinion, get...
And this is, in a sense, the difference between the legal arena and the scientific arena. The legal arena, as I understand it, is based on certainty. What do you know, and when did you know it?
Mm-hmm.
And the scientific arena is what we don't know. Okay, here's what we, you know, here's my model. Here's what it can do. But, you know, we're really uncertain about X, Y, and Z. But we don't think they're really important for the following reasons. So we're always emphasizing our uncertainty, and then these two worlds collide, and climate change is a good point. Where when you read in the newspaper or a magazine about scientists knowing this or that, they always say, yeah, but what we really need to know. And then you get this idea that, gee, maybe they don't know as much as they should know. They might know a lot, but they need to know more. But in the scientific community, if you understand the culture, we know tons.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's really worried about it. The issue is no longer whether there is climate change, and the issue has already even passed by whether humans are causing it. Everybody's pretty convinced that they're causing it. Now it's action of how do we minimize future climate change
mitigation,
and that's kind of where the action really is. Although there's still a lot of details and things to be understood about the climate system to better anticipate what kind of action needs to be taken.
Mm-hmm.
There's some very basic ones that are obvious, I think, to everybody,
right.
But then there's some more nuances in it. That's where the scientific research really comes in.
And is that something that the research of LTER is playing a role in, looking at how, because it's looking at how ecosystems respond to changes?
Oh, very much so, yeah, because each site is looking, it's part of its mandate is looking at its response to climate, and we know a lot about what those responses are across a broad range of environments, everything from the polar, terrestrial, or marine, all the way to the deserts, temperate deserts, to temperate forests of the East Coast or the West Coast. So we know a lot about this. So we're kind of some of the the pinning points of understanding how ecosystems respond to climate change.
This is something I asked Peter, and I don't know if you have a thought about it. From the perspective of a scientist, do you feel that there is a kind of responsibility that you have to, or a need that you have to interface with the general public and help them to understand?
Oh, yeah. This changed completely. Because when I started out in science, it was keep your head low, stay out of the newspapers.
Mm.
You know, if newspapers come to you, fine. You don't go seeking publicity. That's a bad thing. Nobody wants, you know, a big blabbermouth. Now, with climate change, this whole edict, in a sense, has changed such that, and NSF really has been, and NASA for that matter, have been a big proponent of getting science to the people, because in a sense, science is kind of separated from public understanding because science has gotten so complex, and I think partly because of our culture. Now, the funding agencies want to bring that back into the public arena to at least make our results known and appreciated by the public. But now you put this climate change issue in front of everybody, and now it's gone from this is something I should do to this is my duty to be involved and to get the word out. As far as my research is concerned, here's what I'm seeing in the climate change debate. And that's a lot, actually, what I do. You know, there's I don't think I turn down a single request when it comes to talking about glaciers and climate change. I'm out there.
Lucky for me, thank you. is there a danger of that watering down the science?
No, I don't think it has any danger of watering down the science. I think it has a danger of
misunderstanding.
That could be true, but I was thinking more of anesthetizing the public, that everybody's saying that it's climate warming. Okay, fine, climate's warming. What else is new?
Oh, yeah.
I got to catch my bus.
Cycle.
Yeah, right. So people get bored with that message.
Mm.
And that's why I'm thinking that we have to begin to change the message.
Mm-hmm.
And start talking about
the effects.
What we need to do about, you know, how we minimize our effects. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Well, this has been really great. I'm just wondering before we stop rolling, is there something that you feel that you wanted to say that I didn't cover?
No, I think you got it
all right. That was fantastic. Thank you.